This is a recording of our Navin Women's Institute meeting, June the 10th, 1987, being held at Hazel McDonald's apartment. Verna Cotton, our curator, is in charge of the program, and we are remembering cheesemaking and former cheesemakers in our area.
I would like to welcome everyone here tonight, especially our two men that have come to speak to us a little later on. So we'll start with the motto, and it is, an industry without memories is an industry without history. And I would like to ask Jean if she would do the motto.
Do you mind if I set the light better in this? The old song says, memories are made of this. Life is made up of our memories, whether good or bad, our childhood, adult life, and so on. Memories are, in reality, a history of our lives and the people and the events that influenced us. Each community had industries of various sorts, which were set up by the early settlers to fill a long-felt need. One can recall from memory where the cheese factory used to be, where the railroad station stood, where the ball was played on a summer evening, etc. These memories are a vital aspect of the history of Ontario. The historians depend on the memories of the people who at one time lived in certain areas to supply them with the vital events and details needed for their books. These memories, either given orally or recorded, are the foundation of the development of the Archives of Canada. The history of the emergence of the automobile is actually the basis of the history of that era in the life of North America. Memories of the Ford are in actuality the history of Detroit, Oshawa, and the industrial expansion of Canada and the United States. The evidence is strong. Any industry that did not leave permanent memories in the minds of the people and the history of the area was really of little importance.
Thank you, Jean. I'm very pleased tonight to have Gordon Eady and Albert Belanger come and tell us a little about the cheese factory. As you know, Gordon made history, made cheese in Navin a few years ago, and Albert made cheese down at Sarsfield. So before I let them take over, I want to tell you a few things. Gordon was born in North Russell, Cumberland Township. He made cheese at Navin in the old stone building across from Bradley's store. Gordon married Rita Morrison from Navin, and they had two children. He also served in the RCAF in World War II. He was employed by the Civil Service Commission until his retirement. And Albert was born in Hammond, and he attended school at Canaan, Hammond, Rockland, and Kempville Agricultural School. From Kempville, he received his diploma in the manufacture of cheese and butter. Like his father, Albert was very interested in the manufacture of cheese. In 1956, Albert, with his partner, bought the cheese factory in Sarsfield from Roland Seacott. In 1957, they built a new factory called Greenwood Cheese Factory at Murray's Hill. He made cheese there until the factory was closed in 1972. In 1967, Albert entered the political world, from which he retired in 1981. He now enjoys retirement with his family. So I'd like to call him Gordon, if you would like to tell us what he knows first.
Well, ladies, I can't go back too far in the history of the cheese factory in Navin. I also attended dairy school in Kempville, and I got my background in cheese making before I went to dairy school over in North Russell. Where my dad drew milk to the factory there, and I worked under the supervision of Mr. Earl Wynn. His father also was a cheesemaker, and I used to get up quite early in the morning, get on a bicycle, and pedal a mile and a half to the cheese factory and put on a fire, get steam up, level up the vats to take in milk and so on. And it was an exciting adventure being a boy that come off of a farm. But the wages were good. There were 50 cents a day, and you board yourself. And Mom did your washing. And if you blew a tire on the bicycle, well, out of the $15 a month there, you had to sort of get a new tire for the bike. But anyway, I stuck with that and decided I was going to go to dairy school and learn what it was all about. So anyway, the winter of 1937 and 38, I went to dairy school. And from dairy school, I was hired by a cheesemaker at Stardale, that's down near Bantlick Hill. And it was also a joint stock factory like Navin here. The farmers owned the building and they hired the cheesemaker. And I worked under the supervision there of Mr. Alex Stewart. Well, we both came out of dairy school that year. We set our goal at 100% first grade cheese. And this is difficult in any sense of the word, because of the fact that you can get, with no fault of your own, you can get milk past you that will cause a day's make to go into second grade. And but anyway, finishing down there, we did complete the first year in the history of the factory with 100% first grade, and we felt very good about this coming out of dairy school. So the next year was the big step in my life, as the first factory that I took over on my own in Vars, Ontario, where I live now. And Mr. Jim Mitchell was the local dairy instructor. And I might say one of the finest, I think, that you could ask to have as a supervisor. He did everything to give you the direction that you needed in order to accomplish a good day's work. That was in 39 when I made cheese there, and from there I went to Watterson's Corners above Manotick, and from there I came to Navin here in 1941. This was a challenge here due to the fact that the majority of the milk that came into the cheese factory here was surplus milk. At that time, milk was being hauled to Ottawa by truck, and the dairy industry then was such that you had a contract for so much milk, and what was over and above that, you took a considerable cut on it as far as price is concerned. So the farmers elected to send it to the cheese factory and have it made into cheese. I myself was the last cheesemaker that made cheese in the Navin factory. And I think one of the reasons were that on an inspection from the chief dairy instructor from Kempville, he found sufficient fault in the building to warrant a major going over drains and that sort of thing, where bacteria can can grow and cause trouble. Ventilation was one thing I remember. So it was brought to the attention of Mr. Wesley Savage. He was one of the men that I dealt with when I went in to make cheese in the factory, and the option was make the repairs and go ahead and manufacture cheese in the building or close it. Well, the expenditure was going to be reasonably high, and I think it was a wise move by the people involved to close it, because of the fact that we weren't making much more than one 8,000-pound vat in the flow of the milk. So when you add cost to run a boiler and make steam every day, it was decided that when the season finished that they would close the factory. Now, I think maybe there was a number of people involved in this that I didn't know of, due to the fact that I was living towards Russell and not attached to this community here until such times as there was an awful lot of this was that I couldn't remember. But by what I can find out from the setup here, the bank was the people that put up the money for the industry here. I think I might be right in saying that they named it Navin Dairy Limited or Navin Dairy Incorporated or something. I've forgotten now just what name they put on the building. But there was quite a number of the prominent men in the area here that were on the board. And quite a few people had invested money in the building in order to offset the money that was put out by the bank to start the industry going. And I don't know them all. I know of a few. I think Mr. Cotton was one of the men, and Mr. Dick Clark, Wesley Savage. In that age group, there was a number of personnel that were on the board, and then there was people that bought stock in the building in order for it to operate properly. Now, I won't go into detail too much on the manufacture of cheese. I think maybe my experience was that it was get up early in the morning, work like a dog all day if you wanted to get done at night, because I found one of the biggest and best issues in manufacturing of cheese was it wasn't how long your nose was, it was how well you could smell with it. When you knocked the lid off of a can in the morning, whether it was an 8-gallon can or a 30-gallon can, you didn't quite get it all if you were if you had a keen sense of smell, you could pick up something. But I learned as I went along that a nice way to find out where bacteria was growing other than the desirable type of bacteria which we used for the manufacturing of cheese, which was which came from a lactic ferment, the part that lactic acid took in the processing of cheese, and you could get too much of that too, and you could have something that you could wheel out in a wheelbarrow and not put down to press if it was not handled properly. So I got pretty good training under the supervision of Mr. Mitchell, and he told me that, he says, as long as you get that nose on your face, Gordon, he said, I don't think there'll be very much get past you. But in order to prevent some of the problems that you would have in the manufacturing of cheese due to, well, it could be stable flavor. See, not all millionaires sent milk to the cheese factory. So if the cow put her foot in the pail, you couldn't wash the milk, and if you needed it bad enough for to make money, you strained it, you got the heavy of it, and the rest went into the dairy can, which us guys like Mr. Belanger and myself found out later on, and that was, we labeled that stable flavor. Well, that was a real nice name that we had put on it. Anyway, bad dairy cans, broken seams where milk could get in and couldn't be taken out, and bacteria would be allowed to grow, the undesirable type. It would overcome your desirable type, which was your lactic acid, and in order for that your vat would go ahead and give you an ordinary day's work, you would find that it would sit there for a long time and the growth of your lactic ferment would not multiply. It would sit there because it was being killed by something. I developed a system with Mr. Alex Stewart at Bantlick Hill when we come out of dairy school that always worked. If you had any doubts about a can of milk, even you had it dumped in the whey can, didn't mean that you had to pull the plug and let it run in the vat. You could take the can down and set it on the floor, and the boy that was down there swung the leader over. We call it the leader because it was a trough that carried the milk from the whey can to the vat. We would take a dipper full of that, get a pail of real good hot water, and warm it up. And believe me, if there was anything in that that was bad, you would find it. We even found where a man was using a chemical sterilizer, which you rinsed your cans with after washing. You mixed it with water and you rinsed the, this was supposed to kill bacteria and make the can real sanitary for to put milk in. He found out that this might keep his milk from going off flavor. So he was using a little bit of this. With the result was that we were having a problem getting our vats to multiply in our lactic ferment in order to go ahead and make cheese. And then all of a sudden it would take off. As it multiplied, the desirable type would kill off the undesirable. And the result is we found that he had been using this, and we referred him to the local dairy instructor, and he was put under quarantine for 60 days and was unable to sell his milk in the form of milk, cream, butter, or anything. He had to dispose of it by feeding it to the stock. Okay? Now, this is very, very rare. Now, this is somebody that is trying to put something over on the cheesemaker, and we didn't catch it right away. Like, we were going on for probably a week with a problem. So the fact was that it made your day late. You had to be very careful in order to keep your quality of cheese up there, but we did manage, on top of all this, to make our 100% first grade. So I think maybe the fundamentals of manufacturing cheese is known to me, and I will let Mr. Belanger go ahead from there and take you step by step from the time milk is brought in until it is put into the final process of a cheese on the shelf. Mr. Belanger?
Did I use the corner of the table?
Move your chair over.
Over here?
Yeah.
This is just a book I brought here with the Great Canadian Cheese Directory, if you want to look at it after a while. Well, thanks very much for inviting me here this evening. It was a pleasure to accept. I don't expect a big speech out of me. I'm not a speech maker. But I was told one thing when I got into politics. Your speech has to be long enough to cover the subject, but it has to be interesting. Just like a woman's skirt, they said. Well, I was very interested to hear Gordy's remarks, because I ran into the same problems that he did all through the cheese industry. Now, he learned maybe at a later age than I did. I'd say I was born in a cheese factory. My mother had 12 kids, and we had a one-man factory, but mother used to help Dad all the time in the factory. So if we weren't born in the factory, it was not far from it. But from the age till we could walk, we were around the factory and playing around the vats and this and that. So I learned how to make cheese and didn't know what I was doing. I learned how to make cheese before I was 15 years of age, but I didn't know what I was doing it for. I knew I had this to do, this to do, and my dad could leave and leave us boys at home. You see, there was 10 boys there, so there was always one that was big enough to do the work. So that's why I went to dairy school back in 1943. But in those days, like when I first started, or Dad's factory down there, you know, it was most of the factories had one vat. Some of them two. But the big problem was weekends, because the priest wouldn't hear you working on Sunday. But then we started to cheat to work on Saturday night, because people were not equipped to cool milk and keep it in a good condition till Monday morning, keep it for 2 days. So we started to make cheese on Saturday night, so that took care of half the problem. And on Monday, then we had to have two vats. Of course, Mother and Dad and one of the boys was doing this. But in those days, you know, like Gordy was saying, anything comes in milk. I dump a can of milk and found a straw hat in it once. And worse than that, I found a kitten in a can of milk. But, you know, flies by the thousands, they were common then. But in the cheese factories also, we had no screen doors, nothing. You know, before we set our vat, after the milk was all in, we had a dipper with a strainer on the bottom, go around the top of the vat and skim the flies off of it, before going ahead with to make the finished product. But I guess most of the factories were like that in those days. No screen doors. And I remember when the inspector came in, and we had Bill Olmsted from Bearbrook. He came in and he says, there's a new regulation out. You had to put screen doors or screens on your doors and windows. And, well, that was an awful expense then. You know, you didn't mention this, Gordy, but I remember Dad had a cent and a half a pound for making cheese, and he had to supply everything. 1 cent and a half a pound for making cheese, and he had to supply the works. So, you know, it was when he said, and of course we had a meeting every spring to determine how much they're going to pay the maker. And when the farmers got together and said, we'll pay you no more than a cent and a quarter this year, I remember Dad getting up and, well, he says, if that's the case, we might as well not lose any more time here. We'll close the meeting because I can't do it. Oh, hold on, I said. So he got a cent and a half. But it was barely a living. But, things started to improve. We were hampering on quality all the time, cooling. Now up here around Navan, most of the milk that came was surplus from the city, or those who were shipping to the city shipped their surplus to the factory. Well, they were equipped mostly with ice to cool their milk. But farther out, now where I came from, down farther, down in the Birches there, and down in Burchette Hammond, all they had was water tanks. And, of course, they had the big 30-gallon cans, and they didn't have tanks deep enough to cover the milk in the can. So once in a while during the evening they had to go out and stir that milk and change the water on the milk. But still in all, bacteria develop fast in milk that's not cold. And we often had milk that was on the sour side coming in. But that's not too bad, the sour side, because that's lactic acid. But if there was anything wrong with that milk, other types of bacteria, they would develop maybe faster than the lactic acid bacteria. And that's where you run into your problems. Like Gordy was saying, the cow put her foot in the pail. We call that manure gas. We'd have an awful smell on that cheese when we were making it. We knew right off the bat it was manure gas. But, things improved with time. And then the electricity come in and people got coolers. And then the government got after the cheese factories. And that's when many of the factories closed down. They had to renovate or go out of business. So many of them renovated. But 10 years later again, they said, now your factories are too small. You'll have to go into stainless steel, and you can't afford it on a 1 or 2 vat factory or 3 vats. You'll have to, and the government come out of the program, you buy 2 factories and build a new one. We'll pay, what was it? I think it was 90% of the cost, I believe, of the construction and the equipment. Now that's how I built the one in Sarsfield. I bought the old one in December 1956. We took possession January 1957, and we start to build the new one in March or April. But, when Sika had built that factory, he had bought out the Navan permit here, Mizunov's factory, the one on the road that goes to Vars. Yeah. And the one down farther east, where the golf club is, down in Canaan. He had those 2 numbers he'd bought out, and I bought out the Sarsfield numbers, and I got those 2 numbers with it. So by building a new factory, I got the grant from the government. So, the place down there cost $220,000, and I think it was 50% is what we were getting, because I got $112,000 of a grant. That I remember. I just saw the check and I put my name on it, and we didn't use it. Just paid off part of the debt. But that's how all these small factories disappeared, and the reason was because the government was putting on pressure to have more protection from bacterial activity and cleaner, all stainless steel equipment. Because in the beginning, we had those old wooden rakes that we'd walk up and down alongside the vat, to stir your milk and cheese. And those old wooden things, the whey and the milk would get into the joints there, and we had to use a steam on there to try and get that stuff out, but they smelled like hell, a day after they were washed. So we had to get away from all this, and then the farmers also, there was a lot of improvement there. They got to most of them had milking machines and stainless steel strainers, and instead of having the cloth strainer, they had the discs. And it was much better that way, because believe you me, we'd find strainers in some places there that were, you could almost stand. They were just rinsed and put in the line, and they smelled rancid. And of course, that was bad for the milk. So it was improvement on the farmer's side and the producer's side, and improvement on the factory side. until we got into the most recent, the all stainless steel factories, like the one I had down there, and it was much easier to control. And of course, by then we'd got away from the big 30-gallon cans, because the farmers would bring back the whey in the 30-gallon cans. And well, there was an old whey tank outside there, and whey was left over from day to day. And if those cans weren't scalded out, well, bacteria remained in the cans and developed in the milk. So we got away from those, we had got the 8-gallon cans and run them through the can washer at the cheese factory. And, well, that was much better. But some of them were still bringing the whey back in their 8-gallon cans until the Ministry of Agriculture clamped down and said no more of that. If you want whey, you'll have to bring drums or some old cans. So, and then we got into the pasteurization. Of course, in those days, it was all raw milk cheese, Gordy.
Yeah.
All made from raw milk. Then we got into the pasteurized cheese, in the preheated cheese also. Preheated was about up to 142 degrees, I believe, and held for about 30 seconds. That destroyed most of the undesirable bacteria that was in that milk, and it didn't kill the lactic acid bacteria. This was a great step forward to improve the quality of the cheese. But this was only permissible for cheddar cheese that would be used for aging. The raw milk and the preheated or the heat treated, you couldn't use the heat treat, you couldn't use for 60 days. Pasteurized, you could use the next day and sell it, need it. Heat treat had to be 60 days. And of course, the raw milk, well, we made that for export for aging a year. And of course, the cheese you buy in the factories nowadays, or the cheese you buy on the counter nowadays, is pasteurized, and it doesn't change. It can go moldy on you, but the flavor doesn't change, because they've destroyed everything that's in it and put in the proper bacteria and made the cheese out of it. And if it's kept at the proper temperature, it'll keep for a long time. Now, I don't know if you want me to talk about the cheese factories, more about what kind of factories we had, where they were located, or if you want to hear me something on how we make the cheese. I understand, Verna, that you have quite a history on the location of the cheese factories.
I have the history of the Navin cheese factory.
You had one of the just of the Navin?
Yeah.
Oh. Oh, somebody told me today you had the, what is it, the Tweedsmuir report?
Yeah, but I have right here the history of the Navin cheese factory.
But I thought you had the whole township.
No, there's a picture of the cheese factory in Navin and the one across the, beyond this side of the street in 1900.
Between the store here and the bank?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, you have a picture of that one, eh?
Yeah.
What does this one date back to, in the 20s?
This one on this side of the street was in existence, I guess, before 1900.
Yeah, but I mean the one that I made cheese in here.
Across the street.
Probably in the 20s or early 30s.
The Tribune years, the Tribune was distant, there was huge, and he was forced to sell the Tribune.
That's in 1906.
Yeah, he sold in 1906.
So it was before that. I think it'd be interesting to know where all the cheese factories
are. I'll go through it. I'll go through what. I've got the ones east of here in more detail, because I worked on this one for the centennial of the parish of Sarsfield. And we have one, two, three, four. We had six. We had six down in that area. And well, for instance, the one in Sarsfield at the end of the at the end of the 19th century, it could be at the end of the 18th century, the end of the before 1900. At the end of the 19th century. Yeah, there was a factory existing in Sarsfield where Mr. Bourbonnet lives now, across from the Villeneuve's old store, but it wasn't in operation. So Mr. Lafleur built a factory about 1901. lot 10, concession 4, where the apartments of Roger Villeneuve used to be there, just on the north side of the road. That factory was in operation about 20 years. And in 1923, one of my uncles, Osias Belanger, bought and operated that factory for 2 years, and then it was forced to close because of the unsanitary conditions. So the farmers got together and they bought a lot from Andre Farmer, you know, Andre Farmer in the South Fork of Sarsfield, and they built a new factory, and then they sold that factory to Mr. Jubainville. And he had that until he died in 1934. And then Serge Thibault, his brother-in-law, bought the factory and sold it in 1946 to Roland Seacott. And he rebuilt a modern factory.
And in
1956. I said 1957 a while ago. 1956. I bought the factory with a partner, Leopold Pudving. And then we built a new factory in the same year. Moved into it for Christmas,
pardon me,
and closed it down in 1972. Now there was a factory at French Hill, lot 3, concession 4, and Emmanuel Lafleur owned that around 1905. And his son, Ansim, operated it till 1917. And after that it was a man by the name of Mondou, until 1924, and then Eugène Maggi until 1927. And then they renovated the factory and made quite a modern factory out of it. They had 4 vats in there, could handle 32,000 pounds a day, so they were 8,000 pound vats. And between 1927 and 1932, the same uncle of mine that was in Sarsfield and his son Yuval operated it for a while. And then it was sold to the Paquettes, and Mr. Marcel Paquette's father, and then Marcel bought it from his father, and it burned down the 4th of July, 1952. Now there was another factory down on the, I guess on the boundary. It was built, I believe, in the township of Clarence, but it was right on the boundary and served the population of Cumberland Township as much as it did the other. And that's what, just at the beginning of the 20th century, Wallace Charbonneau, he built a factory on an acre of land that was given by Tommy Morris on the lot just on the boundary of Clarence. And in the 30s, Fred LaMarche bought this factory, and his son Silvio bought it and operated it for a while during the 40s. And then it was sold to Willie Carr in 1947, and it operated until it was destroyed by fire. To serve the southeast corner of the township, that's where, I guess, where I was born, to accommodate the farmers in that part of the township, a cheese factory, the owner was Frank Reed. Now, Hazel has a picture of Frank Reed here. She was showing me a while ago. Dad bought that factory from Frank Reed, and in 1919, and he kept it in operation until 1947, and then he closed it down because there was so much pressure at that time to enlarge and have better premises and stainless steel equipment. He couldn't afford to. It was still a 1 or 2 vat factory. And then we had one down here close to Navan on the road that goes to Vars. Abe Nelson, I have here, built the factory at the beginning of the 20th century in lot 13, concession 6. Jack Kyle bought it at a later date, and Oli Legault was the cheesemaker. And then Roger, there may be other people that owned it in between, but Roger Maisonneuve bought it and kept it in operation up to the day that it was burned down. No, I don't have the date. Mrs. Maisonneuve is still living, but when I called her, she couldn't recall the date. Now, I don't know, but did any of you know here there used to be a factory in the village of Leonard?
Yes.
You knew that?
Yes.
That's at the end of the 19th century. There was a factory in operation, lot 14, concession 5, just behind Raffles' store. Now, Mr. LaFleur bought this factory at the beginning of the 20th century and closed it down, transported the equipment to the one that he built in Sarsfield. Now, those are the ones I had that were touching the parish of Sarsfield. What does that do with that other one now? I wrote it all in before I left. The other factories that I've been... here it is here. Yeah, well, we'll see how we make out on the Navan one here. The information I got, to see how it coincides with yours. In the late 1800s, that's just before the 20th century, there was an operational factory located between the bank and Bradley's store of today. Will Monroe operated this factory until a new one was built across the street. The cement block building, which still stands, was owned by Marshall Rapple, is that right? For some reason unknown to me, the cheese milk producers bought the factory and operated it with different cheesemakers. Among those different makers, John Ferguson ran it in 1937-38. What year were you in that one, Gordy?
41.
41?
Yeah.
Did it close after you left?
That's the year it closed.
Oh, in 41.
Well, somebody had to do it, and, you know, I worked at it.
After John Ferguson, 1937-38, he was followed by Huey Reed. And did that ring a bell to somebody, Huey Reed?
Yeah, Huey and his brother made cheese in there.
Oh, yeah.
Mansell, the big cheese and the little cheese.
Uh-huh. Now, there was another cheese factory located at the intersection of Wall Road and the Navan Road in the northwest corner. I haven't got no details on that one, though. At the time, it was owned by Alec McGregor, followed by Arthur O'Neill and Rosalie Chartrand. That's all
Rosario,
I have on that
Rosario
one.
Rosario.
Rosario.
Yeah.
Rosario.
Sid told me about that one yesterday. Rosario Chartrand. Mm. And then called it Rosalie.
Yeah, Rosario Chartrand.
There's one
at
Massey's Corner, too.
Right? Yeah, a little further east in the Scarf Settlement across from School Number 10. Does that ring a bell, School Number 10? Sirson Martin,
right,
operated a cheese factory that went from father to son until it closed. Now, I've been unable to get information on a factory operating on the northwest corner of Innes Road and the 10th Line. That would be Massey's Corner. I didn't get any information on that one. And there were factories also located in the villages of Vars and Bearbrook, which I have been unable to find any, get anything for. Now that is the historical, I suppose, of the cheese factories in Cumberland Township. Now there may be, maybe we've missed some, I don't know, there used to be a factory every 2 or 3 miles then, but now they're larger, much larger. Well, they don't exist anymore, period. See, we have one in St. Albert here, and I don't know. I don't think there's not another one in the eastern part of Ontario, east of Ottawa.
Any Winchester?
Well, the Alts made cheese there.
Yeah.
And the specialty cheese.
Well, they have they make cheese for Kraft, I believe. Now I don't know if they still make for Kraft, but anyway, Kraft have plants operating, and they make these 640-pound squares, you know. And they don't even have to press them, just the weight of the cheese press themselves. And of course Kraft use this to make their processed cheese. It's all sliced and ground and to make their processed cheese. But
these processed cheese people often bought high acid cheese that would not go through the local grader. in cheese factories, as you would know, eh?
Yes.
And it didn't hurt the quality of the cheese that they were making, being that they were making a processed cheese.
That's right.
As a cheddar cheese, the high acid would break down the body in the cheese and make it mealy, eh?
Yeah. But, of course, they buy this to reprocess. They chop it up and they repasteurize it, and
that's right.
They neutralize the acid that's in it, and we could even sell cheese. I remember Chateau Cheese, Ottawa.
That's right.
We had a bunch of cheese that was too open, too many holes in it. Not rat holes or mice holes, I mean too many openness in cheese, you call it. You know, we could sell it to them and...
at a reduced price.
At a reduced, but they were pretty good. They'd give us maybe a half or a cent a pound less, or a cent a pound less, but
right.
It was better than...
Talking about processed cheese food, what are we getting when we buy processed cheese food? What do they mean?
Processed cheese food or processed cheese?
Processed cheese food is what you buy in a lot of the processed.
Well, it's food. What kind of food would have processed cheese in it? It wouldn't be cheese. You'd be getting.
I never understood what the label meant. Anybody know?
That. And they use much of that in all the processed cheeses. Cheese powder, or cheese whey powder.
Right.
It gives the same flavor as cheese.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the cheese slices are just the cheddar cheese that are chopped up and with ingredients added, and they make soft cheese out of it.
Well, is that cheese. Term not used in the slices too?
No,
processed
cheese
food
slices. Albert, may I ask you a question? I maybe shouldn't know the answer. You built that nice new factory on the hill, and why was it opposed? Was it because so much milk went to Ottawa, you didn't have enough milk?
No.
I mean, there it sits now, and it's been, it's still...
It's not because too much milk was going to Ottawa. It was because I wasn't getting enough milk. But that, I'll tell you exactly why that
you
happened.
You weren't getting enough milk to...
No, we're on the quota system.
Oh.
Now, a quota was established back in 1968, I believe. Around 68. And we had our quota of milk. And every factory had their quota, just like the farmers had their quota. Now, why the quotas come in, you know, during the war, the government says, produce all the cheese you can. We have to ship the cheese overseas for the soldiers. Well, we produced a lot of cheese. But after the war, we kept on producing cheese. But England didn't have the dollars to pay for the cheese. Now, at that time, the federal government was paying, the Ministry of Agriculture, was paying a subsidy of 25 cents a hundredweight on milk that went to cheese. We'd end up with warehouses full of cheese that we couldn't sell because England couldn't afford to, they didn't have the dollars to buy it. And what we did send over there, the federal government had to subsidize by 12 cents a pound. So they were already paying 25 cents a hundred on milk, and then they had to subsidize 12 cents a pound to sell the cheese. So they said, we're going downhill, going in the hole very fast. So they said, we're going to establish a quota system. And the farmers were all put on quotas at that time also. And I mustn't get ahead of my story now, but this is what started the whole thing. They cut down on the production of the farmers. If they produced over their quota, they were penalized. Just like they are today in shipping fluid milk. They're penalized if they only get a few cents, a few dollars a hundred for their milk. And the farmers were penalized if they shipped more than their quota. So the farmers said, well, we're not going to ship more milk than we have to. So they just start shipping their quota. And as the demand increased for fluid milk in Ottawa, they'd take some milk, they'd cut down on my quota and ship this milk to Ottawa. And they never did increase the quota to my cheese factory. They never did fill it. See, the third year before I closed, I got 60% of my quota. And the second last year, 56. And the last year, the way it was going, I was going to get 52. Now, those last 3 years, I was just breaking even. So we raised hell, but nothing doing. So then the same people that told us they'd pay us 50% of a grant if we built a brand new factory with stainless steel and everything, said we'll pay you to close it. Because they couldn't, I couldn't operate on 50%, 50 to 55% of the quota. So then they paid me to close the factory down. That's what happened.
I think a lot of this, Albert, was brought about by Milk Marketing Board.
Oh yes, so the Milk Marketing Board, they established the quotas with the national.
And there wasn't anything you could do about it. You just had to close the door and back out. There was nothing to do.
Nothing you could do. The Marketing Board, the Ontario Milk Marketing Board, is a group of milk producers. At least it had to be at the start. Whether it is still, I don't know. They're a group of milk producers, and they're there to protect the milk producer. Now, the other quotas that we had were established by the Canadian Dairy Commission. That's one of them's federal, and the other is a provincial board. And they're often in conflict with one another.
But all was not rosy for the milk producer either.
No.
As some of you wives that are on farms know that there was a few things that went through that should never have gone as far as the dairy industry was concerned in milk.
Yes, but since those boards are in operation, they've been working fine now
for
the producer. But they control milk, they control the production of milk, they control it down to the, you know, St. Albert cheese factory. They had to go out and buy milk from the province of Quebec because Ontario won't supply them with enough milk to supply their customers with cheese. And they sell all their cheese on the local market. All their cheese.
Now, all of their milk comes from Quebec even yet?
Well, when they're short and they can't, when the Milk Marketing Board won't supply them with the milk, then they have to buy it from elsewhere, and they have to pay a premium to get it.
But they get enough money to keep them floating.
Oh yes, oh yes. Well, they have enough milk. They wouldn't have enough milk to keep them going if they didn't buy in the province of Quebec. Of course, this cuts into their profits when they have to pay a premium in the province of Quebec for milk. Because today, all milk is handled by these huge tankers, see? And it's one good thing about it. Now everybody is subjected to the most severe tests in milk production.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And everything has to be,
sanitary.
Yeah.
And temperature-wise.
Yeah, and one of the things, you probably have run into this too, one of the things we dreaded most was a producer who had cows with mastitis, and he gave them a shot of penicillin. That was deadly. Penicillin would just cut the lactic acid bacteria right down to nothing. And I think, is it 72 hours they have to throw out the milk when they inject a cow with the penicillin? I think it's 72 hours.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. But I've seen 2 days' milk, 100,000 pounds of milk a day, 2 days. Put it in a barrel after that was in the cheese and give it away to this piggery who had it here in Orleans.
Yeah.
200,000 pounds of milk. Just by penicillin.
But this shouldn't have happened, eh?
No, it shouldn't have happened.
It shouldn't have happened. That milk should never have gotten into the fluid milk that you were
it shouldn't. It shouldn't, but like you said a while ago, maybe somebody needed the dollars and they thought they'd get away with it.
Well, that's about the size of it.
Yeah. But nowadays, if they're caught doing that, they're cut off. I don't know for how long, but I know there's a heavy penalty for
and
that.
And some of this, Albert, as you know, was ignorance. Some of it.
Yes, probably.
But some of it was.
Well, it was if they gave the injection themselves, but if the vet gave it, the vet would tell them every time.
Yeah.
You can't use that cow's milk for X number of hours.
That's right.
But a lot of them got to buying it themselves, and injecting themselves.
Yeah.
And maybe they didn't know.
There was no way you could tell that in the milk, eh?
No, except sometimes there was, but you know, we were receiving the, if it comes in a bulk tank, no, there's no way. But when we were receiving it in cans, you see, the globules of penicillin would appear on the surface of the milk. But, you know, when you're dumping milk, and you have 1,000 cans to dump, you dump them so fast, you know, you just knock the cover off and smell the cover, and the cover goes into the slot to be washed, and the can is automatically dumped. So you don't have the time to examine and look in the can. But I've been told this, and I've seen it too, globules of, looks like fat floating on the top of them.
In the bulk milk, though.
Well, in the bulk.
You wouldn't be able to, but
no.
The driver should he not have found that in the tank?
No, the driver can't find that because the tank is closed. He starts the agitator in there, and he measures it first, starts the agitator, and starts his pump, and probably doesn't even open the...
Yeah, there'd be too much time involved. You wouldn't get anything else done, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those things that education will eliminate the most of it if you can get the people educated and tell them what is happening.
But it's nowadays, I guess it's the industry has it down quite pat.
Yeah, and it's a good thing too.
Oh yes, because you see, our cheddar cheese is recognized the world over as being the best in the world.
Yeah,
and I guess Canada wanted to retain that, and that's why they got stricter, and the province also with the inspectors, instructors, and you mentioned Jim Mitchell a while ago. Jim Mitchell's a great friend of mine. He's a great chap.
During the 39-45 years there of
Warriors.
War, we had one of the biggest markets for cheese in Britain that you could ask for anywhere, just the finest. And we even cut the big cheese into three and recapped them and sent flats, made 10-pound loaves and waxed them.
Yeah.
That was all overseas stuff, you know.
That's during the war years, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, we established a great market over there, but of course we couldn't continue after the war because of the shortage of money.
Yeah, the dollars weren't around.
But it improved, and then we got into the pasteurization, those 10-pound squares we make, like what we buy in the stores, the St. Albert cheese, that's pasteurized. If you buy the medium or old, that's made from just heat-treated milk, or raw milk. But they still put out a very good cheese, St. Albert. I buy the old cheese all the time. I buy some fresh, too, for the kids. They won't eat the old. But their old cheese, I've been buying it there ever since I closed down, and I don't recall once of getting anything that was bad, not once. So they have very good cheese out there. Oh, by the way, this here was I don't know if you know what this is, but you would. This is my dad's old boring iron. And my dad started in the early 1900s, so it's an old one. This is after we used to make the large 90s, the big round ones, you know? And if we wanted to check a week later to see what the quality was, or just before shipping, see, we had to hold them, was it 10 days? We had to hold them on the shelf before boxing and shipping?
Yeah, I've forgotten. I think around that somewhere.
Okay, so we'd sample one. You see, on a vat of 12,000 pounds, we'd probably have 11 or 12 of these big cheeses. So we'd drive this into one of the cheese, turn around, and pull out a plug. So the top end here, the 2 inches, we'd break off and put back in the hole. And then we'd examine the rest of the cheese. Well, that's how the cheese, the federal cheese raters do it too. Yeah. And of course you had to examine the cheese for color, texture, and flavor. And I had the points here, I don't know if I marked them down or not on this. Yeah, here someplace.
Call that instrument again?
It's a cheese boring iron.
Some used to refer to it as a trier.
A trier, yeah. Cheese trier.
Yeah.
Cheese trier, yeah. And this was the one I had when I first started off in Bourget. See, I made cheese in Bourget for 11 years before I came to Sarsfield. And this is the one I used to use down there. This was more like the graters were using. They had it was 3/4 inch in diameter. Whereas the others here were narrower. But, you know, you judged it for flavor, color, closeness, texture, and it was a maximum points for each one of those. And if you get 92 points, then you had first grade cheese. And if it was very good, 93 points. And there was a cent premium on 93. scoring cheese and 2 cents premium on 94. So 1 year they come out with a 95 score. I didn't get too many of those, but I got some. But there was no difference in the premium they paid. But I recall the first factory I took over, that was in Bourget, back in 1947, I guess. 1947, 46 or 47. On the day of the opening, I had one vat of second-grade cheese. The rest of the year was 100%. I had one vat, first day we opened. So I was very fortunate, fortunate, because when you first start out like that, you know, if you have too much poor cheese, it's bad. Now, of course, do you realize that cheese is about the only manufactured product you can buy in a store that hasn't been, that's natural, hasn't been adulterated in any way, except with the lactic acid we add to it. Of course, that's natural in milk, and the rennet for coagulation and salt. It's just as pure a food as you can buy, a manufactured food. And of course, milk. Well, we all know what milk is, but they have, you see this on TV sometimes, beautiful cold, beautiful milk being dumped. It is a very natural and the most natural product that one could drink. But, you know, years and years ago, I don't know when, but maybe before Christ, but anyway, they discovered there was fat in milk. And this was discovered over in India when the ladies used to transport the milk in goat skins. And during the heat of the day, and the milk was agitated in those skins, they'd turn up with globs of butter fat. And you know what they did with this? They used it for their hair. The ladies used it to grease their hair. That is the first use of butter fat in milk. You wouldn't like that, Hazel? but anyway, where did I have that? Okay. Now, I don't know, I suppose many of you know exactly what is in milk, but first of all, there's 87.2% water. So in 100 pounds of milk, there's 87.2% pounds of water, and there's 3.7% fat, 3.5 pounds of fat per 100 pounds of milk, 3.7. When I went to dairy school, it was 3.5, and I got this information from a fellow who went to dairy school 5 years later, and of course with all the improvement of the herds, the average percentage of fat has come up. They have it at 3.7. Casein, 2.75. Albumin, 0.65. Lactose, that's milk sugar, 5%. Mineral matter, 0.7. They make 100%. Now, the whole secret, the whole process in making cheese is to remove the fat, the milk solids, that includes the fat, from the milk, processing it and turning it into a solid product. That's the process of making cheese. Now, Gordy mentioned the lactic acid culture. Years ago, we used to start off with one in the spring we get from the dairy school, but nowadays, they use a new one every day. They buy one, they have them coming in from a lab every day. They're expensive, but a lactic acid culture is made by, in the lab, they sterilize milk, kill everything that's in it, and then they inject it with lactic acid producing bacteria. Now they have the Streptococcus lactis and the Citrococcus lactis. One of them is an acid forming bacteria and the other is a flavor producing bacteria. Now they inject this sterile milk with these bacteria and develop a culture, and then they keep it. When the culture is very active, then they fill small vials, and when you order one, they send you one of these vials. Now, when you get this, you have to take a quart jar of pasteurized milk, cool it down to 70 degrees, and dump this little vial in there. Overnight, it should be coagulated the next morning, coagulated solid. And when it breaks up, I'm getting ahead of myself. Now, when we make cheese, we have to use this culture in a vat of milk. Now, we use about 200 pounds in a 12,000 pound vat. So we have our special tank for making the cultures. We pasteurize it, cool it down to 70 in the morning or afternoon, and at 5 o'clock at night, you dump this quart of culture in there. The next morning, it's coagulated, and we add it to the vats. About 200 pounds per 12,000 pounds of milk. And of course, this is specifically to speed up the development of lactic acid and help destroy undesirable bacteria that are in there. And if you have a good, very good culture, you don't have too much of a problem. Now, we have a vat full of milk, and we've added the culture, and we make a test of the percentage of acidity that's in that milk. If your culture is a little lazy or slow, we may have to wait before we go ahead with that vat. But if I recall correctly, you have to have 21% acidity, or 0.21% before you...
Okay.
And then we add to that, we have to have agitators in there to keep very well agitated. We add rennet to do the coagulation. Now, rennet is an extract from the calf's stomach. It's the product in the calf's stomach that makes the milk coagulate as soon as the calf drinks it. Now, we all have that. The human body has that too, because after a child is so many minutes after he drinks milk, it's supposed to be coagulated. And if he doesn't produce enough rennet in his own stomach, then we have to, matter of fact, my oldest daughter, we had to give her, put lactic acid in her milk.
Is this derived from the third or fourth stomach of a calf?
This I can't tell you. I don't know.
So, it's in that range someplace.
Yeah.
There's a special part of the calf's stomach,
right,
that produces this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was for a while there that we ran short of rennet from a calf's stomach. They had to use pepsin. You ever use that?
Never
pepsin?
Did, no.
No. We ran short because people weren't raising calves. Let me try and recall why they weren't raising calves. Maybe the price wasn't high enough, or maybe they kept all the milk. There was no penalty on shipping milk then. And they were killing the calves, or even giving them milk.
You were getting $2 for a calf.
Yeah.
That's
okay, well, because of the price then. Well, anyway, everybody was killing their calves, and we ran short of rennet to make cheese. And they used pepsin after that, but it wasn't as good. Now, coming back to the setting of the vat, we call a setting of the vat is putting the rennet in it and letting it sit until it's coagulated. So we use 3 ounces of rennet, 3 or 3.5 ounces of rennet, for 1,000 pounds of milk. We dump it in, and we let the agitator run, I think it was 2 minutes, if I recall correctly, and then stop the agitation. And in 20 to 22 minutes, we should have a solid coagulation. Solid coagulation. And it's a sweet coagulation. It's done with the rennet. Now, comes the manufacturing part. You have to cut that. Many of you have bought cottage cheese, I suppose. You see those small granules in there, cottage cheese. Well, we have to do the same thing with cheddar. But we have one set of knives, I should say. They're about 3 feet wide. One has the wires horizontal, at a quarter inch between. The other has them horizontal, a quarter inch between.
Vertical.
Yeah. Vertical, and the other's horizontal. Now, when the coagulation is ready, we put these knives in at the end of the vat, one of us on each side of the vat, and we take the knives and walk up to the other end. That cuts both ways. Then we change knives, the other side, we walk back. And then we have to use the vertical knife and cut crossways into that. That cuts it all up into quarter-inch cubes. And you already, you can see the whey coming out of those cubes. Okay, the trick after that is to put our agitators on there and agitate them very slowly to start with, not to break the curd because it's very soft. And a few minutes, we let it run about 5 minutes, and then we turn on the heat slowly. And with the agitation and the temperature coming up, you see, we set the milk at a temperature of 85, 86. Now we have to bring that temperature up to 101 or 102. And as we do that, the granules shrink, the whey comes out of them. Until the granules get small and they get harder. Now after we're cooked up to 102 degrees of temperature, we take the acidity of the vat and we lower the whey on it. We lower it down to the level of the cheese. And then we keep stirring it, of course, with a different type of agitator. It's a fork, rather, that stirs the granules. And we measure the acidity on there, and when it gets to the proper, where we want it, the proper acidity, then we drain the remaining liquid. And those granules have got down to about, oh, good heavens, size of a small pea.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we make a ditch down the center of the vat. Of course, your vats used to tilt. You mentioned tilting vats a while ago, but the new vats we had down here, you didn't tilt them, but they were 3 inches deeper one end than the other.
Oh, yeah.
So we had a valve, an outlet.
Self-draining.
Yeah, self-draining. And we'd run a ditch down the center and let it drain. And of course, if it wasn't firm enough, we had to keep working it with forks by hand. It's all done by hand, then, working it with forks to get more moisture out of it until it was firm enough. If it was too soft, too much moisture, well, it would make a very poor quality cheese. But if you wanted a soft cheese, it'd leave more moisture in it. But if you wanted a cheese for exporting, you had to get more moisture out of it. And the more moisture you got out of that cheese, the more certain you were of getting the bad flavors out of it. So I recall the first year I made on my own in Bourget, you know, the graders used to try that cheese, and they'd say, "Albert, what are you doing with it? Are you trying to wear it out before putting in the hoops?" It was so hard. You know, they could hardly break it down. The texture was too hard on it. But anyway, after we've got the proper texture to those granules, we pile it up on each side of the vat. Oh, about that wide and about that thick. And we leave it sit there, and it all starts to go together just like bread dough. Just like bread dough. Then we had the cheese knife. We'd cut it into strips, maybe 12 inches wide, and turn them over. And then you see the more whey running out. And you keep turning it over until you could take a piece of that stuff and pull on it just like a rubber tube. It was just like elastic. And when it got down to the point where you couldn't see no more granules and it was just as smooth as silk, then you put it through the mill, the curd mill. That's where you made the curds. Now, it was very different kinds of mills, but we'd cut them into squares about like this and this length and just fit it into the box had two sides to it, and the curds came out under it. Now, we had to keep those curds. We had the agitator, we had the special agitator, the forks, for the curds to keep them from going together, sticking together, because they were still quite warm. And when we got those curds just as smooth, every side of the curd was just as smooth as the outside was before we started putting them through the mill, silky smooth, then we could crack the salt to it. And 3 pounds of salt per 1,000 pounds of oil, is that it? Two and a half, 3 pounds?
Depending on how high you cook today.
Yeah, well, depending on the moisture content you had. If you had a high moisture content, put in a little more salt, that would shrink it up more and throw out the moisture.
If you were cooking to 104, you'd put a little less salt.
Oh, yes, yeah, because you had a firmer curd,
yeah,
at 104. But anyway, depending on the type of curd you had, it was firm curd or soft curd, you varied your salt application. And after the salt, of course, kept the fork stirring in it there for a while, and when the more whey was running out of it, well, you pull the curds up to one side of the vat and let the whey run out, and then put the curd in the hoops and press them there till the next day. Next day you took them out and you had a block of cheese. So in a few words, you know, that's how cheese is made. The cheddaring process is when you pile it up on each side of the vat after the whey is off and it knits together. And you keep turning it and you keep folding it in two until it's the whole thing is just as smooth as silk. If you don't do that long enough and you have a lot of little granules left in it, then you draw a plug out of a cheese and you see some holes in it, could cause that. Well, I don't know if you have any questions you'd like to ask me on this. Cheese, a finished product, I must tell you, is cheddar cheese, 34.48% water, 34.07% fat, 31.45% casein and mineral. So it's evenly divided amongst water, fat, casein, mineral. So that's about it on the cheese making part of it. If any of you have any questions that I didn't touch on or anything, just please ask. I'd be happy to answer, if I can.
I might add, Albert, that probably some of these people don't know that not all the butter fat is removed. Some of it goes out in the whey.
Oh, yeah.
And some places were set up, equipped with separators, and they would separate the whey and take what they call whey cream. And the farmers often took this in Bantlickhill. They took it home and made their own butter. And in another factory that I made in, I made the butter as well as the cheese. And we just set the cans of the cream, very, 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 very rich butter fat cream, you might say, that if you set it in cold storage, you could hardly dump it out of the can. It was that thick.
You just spoon it out or cut it out with a knife.
Yeah, but this made a very, very good quality of butter and lovely flavor. Like for the spread on toast in the morning, it was really something.
It had a cheesy flavor to it. Yeah, cheesy flavor.
Yeah. So that didn't make quite as good hogs, but it made good butter, you know.
But you know, I did find out after that cream that was left in the before we run it through a separator, that cream was no good for the pigs anyway. It had no value for the pigs.
Yeah.
The fat on there didn't.
That's right.
So.
Well, Albert and Gordon, I wish to thank you both very much for coming tonight. I think everybody has enjoyed your little history on the making of cheese. So thank you both very much as a token of appreciation.
Thank you very much.
Oh, heaven.
That wasn't necessary. It was a pleasure coming down here and entertaining you.
Enjoyed having you and
have
a pound of cheese.
Blue.
Can we get a picture of the two of you together?
Ah, darn it, I'm not photogenic.
Oh, yes, you are.
Get over here.
I have lots of pictures of you.
Here, I'll get out of the way.
Where did you get lots of pictures of me?
Remembrance Day, sir.
Oh. You can come over here, Gordon, and she can take your picture. Oh, well,
turn the light off?
Hello. Gosh.
Behind the light or in front of it?
How are we doing?
Well,
we got to get our cheese makers.
Well, if Albert goes over this way,
maybe. Pardon? Okay. I think so.
We'll go around here. Okay.
Yeah, right there.
Over here?
Yeah.
Stand right in front of
me,
Albert.
Stay tight together. Tight together.
You have to get Eileen and Hazel in here.
No. Tight together. Tight.
Tight together?
Okay.
That's what I need now.
Thank you. Thank you. Don't show it to anybody.
Hope it didn't break your camera.
No, just
show it to anybody.
Here.
Don't enlarge it.
No. Big enough.
We have the roll call.
How do you spell the word casein?
C-A-S-E-I-N. Or is it I-E-N?
Casein.
E-I-N.
E-I-N.
Yeah.
That was a new word to me.
Well, casein, it's the solids in milk. It's the calcium.
We'll have the roll call,
Jen.
Okay. Hilda?
Well, we were to name a cheesemaker, and I had chosen Thurston Martin, who was at the factory out at the number 10 area. Mm-hmm. Bev?
I have Royden Olmsted from Fairbrook.
Helen?
I had Arthur O'Neill, who was the cheesemaker at the corner of the Wall Road and our road there, just on the corner of the Christie Farm. And there was the Mr. Sharpdraw was the last cheesemaker after Mr. O'Neill.
Mary?
Actually, I live here. He used to make cheese down beside the Dashney. Mm.
Verna?
Or Needy.
What?
Oh, well, there's Olmsteds at Fairbrook. They gave me W.H. Olmsted. That was the father, wasn't it? Royden's father?
Yeah.
That was the old gentleman.
Mildred?
I had almost. Thurston Martin's son, Stuart Martin. Yeah. I come up.
Doreen Hardiman?
I don't have anybody.
Oh.
I was late.
Mrs. Bradley?
Phil Watson, he used to make cheese here at Navin.
Hazel?
Well, I had Frank Reed because I have a picture of him here. This is my mother in that long white apron. And he's sitting on the Miranda railing. He boarded at Grandpa Grand Birch's. And this in the background is the Boulanger cheese factory. They're cutting wood in front of Grandpa Birch's, but this is where Albert was born and
where he started.
And there is Frank Reed, the man who owned the factory. He came down to visit. Only we were in Navin here. He came down to visit and I took him around to visit the place.
Eileen?
I had Arnold Smith made cheese at Navin.
Jean?
John Ferguson.
Janet?
Albert Boulanger?
Doreen Edgerton?
Invention from Forest.
Joyce?
Roger Mason, I'm from 8 Mills, and she's
rather. Yeah, that's all. Did I miss anybody? Okay, I guess we still have the collection, Jackie. Yeah, you forgot the collection. And should I send this paper around, Joyce?
Good idea. I was going to see.
And then we'll know who you all here and. Like, if you think you're going, otherwise we don't have to call you.
Excuse me, Hilda, may I also say, if anybody wants to take this and fill it out, has any ideas, this came through from the area PRO to our district